number of years now, we've been hearing the phrase cancel culture. It's really been in and out of the news, and once again has really emerged into the national discussion in the wake of the recent protests, of some of the political unrest, and the call for the demolition, the toppling of statues, and the sort of removing of much of what we consider to be our historical legacy, painful at times as it certainly has been. So what exactly do we mean by cancel culture, and where is it heading, and why are we now grappling with it in such a fearsome way today? To talk about all of that, I'm joined by Dr. Bradley Lewis, who is a professor of philosophy at the Catholic University of America, and he is also the author of a really good piece at the National Catholic Register. The title of it is Canceled by the Cancel Culture. Dr. Lewis, welcome.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
So, for those who are new to the concept of cancel culture, what is it?
Well, it's a phenomenon that I think has been out there for a little while, but I don't remember actually hearing the phrase until sometime maybe last year, but it's become very common in the last couple of months. It's really a kind of almost knee-jerk desire to silence things that you don't agree with, or that you find offensive, and not just that in a way, but to silence people who voice these views, in some cases to get them fired. I mean, somebody says something that you find offensive or disagree with, that they shouldn't have platforms to speak in public, or newspaper columns, jobs as journalists, and any number of things like this. So it's not simply the case that somebody says something, you disagree with it. It's that the disagreement leads you to really want to eliminate that person's voice.
Mm-hmm. And it's striking to me how much of this seems to start with social media. And what does that tell us, sort of, where we are culturally?
Yeah, I think that's correct. I think it does have a lot to do with social media. And it's in a way, it's a kind of dispiriting thing, I think, because, you know, if you think about what the kind of promise of social media was, it's that it makes our public culture more democratic, right? I mean, I remember, you know, a long time ago when I was younger, and, you know, there were a certain number of national newspapers, a very small number, national magazines, and certain columnists or writers sort of had a voice there, and those are the only people whose comments attracted any attention. And now with social media, the number of people whose views kind of make it into the public discourse is much, much larger. So there's a more kind of participatory element to this. It seems more democratic in a lot of ways, but it has the bad consequences that are sometimes associated with democracy too. These mobs kind of get whipped up, and it takes on this political, but not political in the normal sense of the term, political in the kind of bad sense of the term, where partisanship becomes more extreme, and people seem to care more about their own side and kind of emphasizing the views of their own side, that their side is bigger, has more influence, and so forth, than the other side. And again, it introduces a much harsher partisanship and even kind of mob mentality into public discussions.
And you write that the revolution of social media, intended to empower more people and democratize public discourse, increasingly resembles a schoolyard populated by gangs shaking down weaker students for their lunch money or cowing them into self-hatred. As you note, liberalism looks a lot less liberal, and you ask, can it maintain itself under such circumstances?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, again, I just mentioned democracy, and mm-hmm. social media is supposed to make our public discussions more democratic. But if you also think about this word liberal, and we usually say what we have is a liberal democracy.
Right.
I mean, liberalism stands for freedom. I mean, that's traditionally what it's always stood for. And it comes from the word liberality, which was the name of a virtue at one time, which really means generosity. And these phenomena have reduced liberality, reduced generosity, have made people intolerant of views that they disagree with, and views that, that would have, in many cases, seemed perfectly normal, you know, a couple of years ago, even a couple of months ago in some cases. Now mm-hmm. the person says it and you want them silenced. And it's a real question how you can maintain a kind of free culture of political and sort of more general cultural discourse without that generosity.
It must be, for example, very perplexing to the author of Harry Potter, J.K. Rowling, who I think most people would have just assumed was a very orthodox type of a liberal in many of her positions, and yet she has found herself under massive assault for, as you write, defending the natural basis of sexual differences. And in that sense, then, what are the ground rules, or are there ground rules for who's attacked and who isn't?
I really don't think you can say that there are ground rules. It's again the part of the social media aspect of this is you don't know what's going to provoke a huge negative reaction. And there's, and for precisely this reason, you know, there's a kind of injustice to this. I mean, people are being held to standards of what's acceptable in public in a kind of retroactive way, right? I mean, the rules change on a momentary basis, and you can be held to have violated them for something you might have done a long time ago.
That doesn't 30 years in some cases, I'm noticing. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's extraordinary. And it's the kind of thing morally, you know, we would never accept in a legal system or something like that. You convict somebody for something that wasn't a crime 20 years ago, but it is now. And that's really, really problematic, I think.
So you also write, and this to me is very, very important to try to impart, that among the terms that St. Thomas Aquinas used to describe human relationships were communicatio and conversatio. The former, you say, is rooted in the word for common or shared. To communicate is to share, and social life is literally of shared institutions, actions, and ideas. What would Aquinas make of our moment?
Boy, that's it's hard to imagine that. You know, of course, in the 13th century, the public sphere was very, very different than it is now. But I think we have to take our bearings by these kind of general concepts, you know. That the terms that I mentioned there, those Latin terms, communicatio or conversatio, communication and conversation, were terms that Thomas used frequently, really quite frequently, to describe political society as a society that was inherently rational. And that was mainly about a kind of shared deliberation, to talk about what our common future will be. And that goes back to Aristotle. I mean, Aristotle says a political community is a community of discussion about what's just and unjust and advantageous and disadvantageous and so forth. And it's made up of rational discussion. The great American Jesuit theologian John Courtney Murray made a lot of this in his book We Hold These Truths, which was published in 1960, that civilization is really about conversation and communication. Mm-hmm. And barbarism is the opposite of those things. And he was, I mean, so that tells you something right there. I mean, he was concerned about this in 1960. But obviously things have changed a lot since then. But you just can't have one community with people who are citizens and involved in civic life if you don't have conversation, and you can't have conversation if you're not willing to listen to the other people and to have an argument.
Well, exactly.
And that's the real danger of this.
And in American history, certainly, we can find many, many examples of a lot of bickering. But there seemed to be at least a determination to pursue, from a Catholic social teaching standpoint, the common good, that which is best for the country. Have we lost an ability to have a kind of common language, certainly in morality? And in so doing, have we also lost then a vision collectively for what might be the common good?
Yeah, I certainly think it's far harder to talk about those things now. It's that the what's common is a lot less than it used to be. I mean, there's certain things that I think, again, still they're sort of there. They're available to serve as common reference points, and they're fairly obvious in the case of the United States, right? I mean, you think about our political regime. What are the basic principles of it? And they're laid out in the Declaration of Independence and in the Constitution. And you think about the Declaration in particular, that there are self-evident truths, that all men are created equal, endowed with rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And those are the real kind of rock bottom values that Americans have always looked to. And even those things are under attack in some ways. You know, I mean, when you hear, you know, people want to tear down the Jefferson Memorial because Jefferson owned slaves, and he did, and of course nobody would approve of that now, and you can look back on it and be very critical of it. But he also had this vision for our politics, which continues to animate it, and which really established the conditions that allowed ultimately for the abolition of slavery. And so I don't know how we are the country that we have been without those values and reference points. And there are increasingly fewer of them, but I think we have to appeal to those.
And how important is a loss, not just of that common language, but also a sense of a loss of history and understanding of the context of it, but also how we got here? One of the things that strikes me about the tearing down these statues is this effort to sanitize history.
Yeah, and this is a sensitive thing, you know, and I think there have to be certain distinctions made.
Absolutely.
You know, I think with taking down some of these Confederate statues in some of these cities in the United States, it seems to me there's a case to be made for that, you know. I mean, it simply is
exactly
true that in a lot of cases, those statues, some of them were put up, you know, really not that long ago, you know, in the 20th century. And the context of it in some cases clearly was the opposition to the integration of schools and to the end of the Jim Crow laws and segregation. And they were an instrument in some cases of white supremacy, I think. And I can understand why people would be offended by that, would want to take them down. Now, that's not the case with all of them necessarily, but it certainly is true in some cases. And so you have to make distinctions between those and other things and the context in which we can think about our history. But it's also important that, the way to deal with this is not simply for some huge group of people to simply march downtown and start to destroy things. Again, there has to be deliberation about this. There has to be discussion and not simply a kind of mob rule. And once that becomes legitimated, then it's pretty hard to control, you know. You say, well, okay, they tore down a Confederate statue somewhere, and maybe that doesn't offend me that much. And then the next day, they're tearing down statues of Christopher Columbus, or they're tearing down statues of saints.
This needs to be a very civil and deliberate process. Understood. Well,
absolutely.
Dr. Bradley Lewis from Catholic University of America, thank you so much. I know that this is a topic we'll be talking about for a very long time. When
sure
we come back, I have a few final thoughts on this hour here on Cresta in the Afternoon.